Every great company starts the same way, with a dream. Not a pitch deck, not a spreadsheet, but a vision. And behind every entrepreneur is the same starting point, a belief that something better is possible and the willingness to take on the risk of trying to build it. Welcome to Dreaming Big. I'm Alexis Allen, and I'm a relationship manager on the Texera Locker Group at UBS. I've spent the last decade working alongside founders across industries and stages. From ideas scribbled on napkins to companies scaling faster than anyone expected, I have seen what it really takes to turn vision into reality. What has always drawn me is not just the outcome. It is the optimism, the grit, and the ability to hold a vision long before anyone else believes in it. On Dreaming Big, I sit down with entrepreneurs to talk about where that dream started, the moments that shaped them, the pivots they did not plan, what they're building, who they're becoming, and the lives they're trying to live along the way. And so we go deep into identity, turning points, joy, and the seasons where that dream felt fragile but somehow survived. This isn't just a podcast about startups. It's about making something out of nothing, about protecting an idea long enough for it to become real, and about the courage to keep going day after day. And so whether you're building your first company, scaling your fifth, investing in a founder, or simply drawn to people who see the future before it exists, this is for you. This is Dreaming Big. And so let's dive in.
Today, I'm talking with Caroline Howard, who is one of the co-founders of Walker Brothers. She is not affiliated with UBS Financial Services, Inc., and her views are her own. Walker Brothers is a Nashville-based kombucha company that has crafted kombucha and hard kombucha. What makes this story especially fun is that Walker Brothers was started by two brothers, Sam and Luke, who love craft beer, but hated how it made them feel. They inherited a Scooby from their aunt and started brewing in their kitchen pantry and garage, and Caroline has been there since day one. She has an amazing background. She's a Vanderbilt grad, worked in advertising technology at Index Exchange in New York and London, and then got her MBA with distinction from Oxford. She even was an angel investor at Hustle Fund. And what I love most about Caroline's story is her unconventional path to the world of food and beverage, about how she has built a business rooted in family culture, and how she has used all of her previous experience to bring it to Walker Brothers.
Caroline, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks so much for inviting me.
So I wanted to give a little context to how we were ever connected. And I think it's a really beautiful reflection on the ethos and generosity that come with Walker Brothers. Many years ago, I was training for the marathon and I was hosting a fundraiser and had reached out to a couple of brands and companies that I loved and admired. And I reached out to Walker Brothers and you donated a couple of items for my fundraiser, which was a great success. But thank you for that. And thank you for joining the podcast. I'm really excited to dive into your background and the story behind Walker Brothers. So what I would love to do is, if there's something that is important for me to know about you, I would love for you to share that. So that could be anything from how you were raised or an early experience that shaped you, a belief system that you developed really to help me understand what created the foundation for who you are today.
Gosh, well, that's a very deep question. I would say foundationally for me, my faith is very important. So I think for me that's always been an important part of my life. But as an entrepreneur, it's become even more crucial to lean on. So that's probably the first thing that underpins my philosophy. And then kind of more generally speaking, like how I became an entrepreneur, both of my parents are not entrepreneurs. My dad worked at the same company for over 40 years. So didn't come from family, but as a high schooler, a new shop opened up in town that was called Initial This. It was like a monogram store. And, you know, where I lived, we didn't have a monogram store, like, you know, like any cute real gift stores and stuff. And so I was so excited that the store opened and went by probably like every week from the day the store opened to introduce myself and be like, hey, like when you hire an employee, like, please hire me. And eventually ended up being the first employee that Julie, the owner, hired, and like really loved that experience, getting to be in on the early days with building that business with her. And, you know, it's still really successful and, you know, it's fun to get to know the customers and, you know, kind of have a voice in what merchandise we curate and stuff like that. So that was really my first exposure to entrepreneurship. And in every situation since, where I've been in, you know, like a more corporate role and then had this like opportunity to jump in a more entrepreneurial environment, I've always just been drawn into that. And so that was probably my first kind of taste of entrepreneurship. And, you know, it's not like I knew from that moment that I wanted to be an entrepreneur, but even came back, it's like, even, you know, at 16, 17, this is something that I've always been drawn to.
That is such an interesting story that you kind of sought it out in your early years and really got to experience what it was like to build a company from nothing. So that maybe was one of your first working experiences, but I would love for you to take me back to post-undergrad. Tell me a little bit about kind of the early days of your career. And maybe a little bit more of your career arc.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to share. After graduating from Vanderbilt, my first job out of college was as a technical recruiter in New York City. I did not like that job, but I was quite good at it. And it was a great first job to have because it's very like eat what you kill. You need to have a really strong work ethic and like drive to be successful. And so it was a great kind of like first entry into the workplace. But like I said, I didn't love it. And looking back, like I couldn't put my finger on it at the time, like why I didn't love that work. But looking back now, I think what was really missing from that for me was this just overall idea of business building and like being more involved in like the actual like running of the business, of the strategy. And so that was really absent in that job. And so looking back, I can see why that wasn't necessarily a fit, even though I had, you know, skills that made me good at it. But so, yeah, did that for a year. And then one of my friends was, you know, I was telling him that I was, you know, kind of starting a job search. And he was like, oh, well, I just joined this company, Canadian advertising technology company, bringing their headquarters, their commercial headquarters to New York. And like, we're building out this office. You should think about joining us. And so I knew nothing about advertising technology, but thought that that sounded really interesting and like a cool opportunity to be one of the first employees in New York. And so that was the, you know, kind of entry level. And, you know, the company itself was also in a real growth period at the time. And so as a result of that, and then also kind of the kind of hard driving approach that I brought to the role, I ended up advancing quite quickly within that business and ended up being transferred to the company's newly opened London office to kind of, you know, bring New York best practices to this newly opened team. And really that's where my career kind of took off, I would say, was in that position. I essentially became our new markets person. So as we would enter into new countries within EMEA or even further afield, I was kind of one of the first people on the ground alongside the country manager that we had hired, you know, in market to meet with potential clients and figure out what was important to them, what that meant for the business and our offering and how we might need to adjust it. And so I had this really cool dynamic role that I really loved and was fortunate to, you know, to be a part of, that ultimately led me to get my MBA is we were wanting to expand into APAC, so Asia Pacific. We had opened our Australia office. And so I had been a real key part of that, which involved living in Australia for a little bit, which is super cool. But we wanted to enter like Asia more specifically. And Japan seemed like the best way to do that. And so we ended up doing that via a joint venture with a Japanese ad tech firm. And then it was handed over to me to operationalize and figure out how that would work in practice. And I just loved that experience and was like, I want more of this in my career, and realized that, you know, in order to be in a role that was more like that, I really needed to go back to school and understand, you know, how to read the three financial statements and some things like that. I had been basically a rhetoric major at Vanderbilt. So I read speeches and analyzed them according to their historical context, which I loved. But so that's how I ended up deciding to get my MBA and leaving the corporate world.
I love your reflections on both like what you didn't love about your first job and how you kind of sought that out later in your career, but also recognizing some of the gaps. You know, I think when people think about going back to business school, it's sometimes during a period of uncertainty where, you know, they're looking to pivot of some sort. But for you, you had a sense of what you wanted to do and you wanted to fill those gaps in kind of a very clear way. So tell me a little bit about your time getting your MBA at Oxford. And then also when you were there, whether you had a sense of what you necessarily wanted to do afterwards.
Yeah. So after I had gotten into the MBA program, that was in like December of 2018. And we were back in Nashville, visiting my family. So Nashville, Tennessee is where my family's from. It's where Walker Brothers is as well. So you might be able to see where this is leading, but we were visiting two friends of ours, my husband and I, were Sam and Luke Walker. And they were like, oh, you know, like we're thinking about building a business around this kombucha that we're brewing in our house. You know, you guys are business savvy. What do you think? And so, you know, we looked into it and it felt like there were a lot of interesting tailwinds in the better for you beverage space, and ended up writing the first check into the business. So seeding the business into existence. And then at that point, I knew I'd gotten into business school already. So I knew I was going to be leaving my job at some point to go back to school. And so I elected to leave a little bit earlier than I had planned and, you know, kind of help Sam and Luke get this thing off the ground, not intending to be full time in the business at any point, really, but just, you know, like, oh, this will be like a fun project before the MBA. So I have this like little small investment that I made and into the business, and then, you know, kind of starting to get the like really ground up operator juices flowing. So that's kind of like the context with which I entered the MBA program. It's like, okay, I know that I love these entrepreneurial environments, being in a business that was like rapidly scaling. And then now I'm getting this perspective as an investor, but also helping get a really small business, you know, going. So that was kind of like the mindset with which I entered the MBA. And, you know, there were a lot of things that I thought I might want to do post MBA, whether that was, you know, go back into ad tech, but maybe in a corporate development function, or potentially be, like a seed investor, or, you know, kind of something like that. And so during the MBA, that influenced what I spent my time on and like what elective courses I took. And so kind of the two biggest things for me during the MBA were the Oxford Seed Fund. So I was one of the co-leaders of the Oxford Seed Fund, which is an investment group at Oxford that invests in Oxford-linked ventures. So I was really involved in that. And then also took as many courses related to entrepreneurship as possible. So like entrepreneurial finance, strategy and innovation. But my experience at the Oxford Seed Fund really showed me that I cannot just be an investor in a business. Like, I really love to get involved and be part of seeing it off the ground. Like, I'm not someone that can just like write a check and then, you know, like hear about what's going on later. I get really personally invested and want to use my skill sets to, you know, to further things. So that was probably the biggest takeaway from that experience, is that whatever I did post MBA, I needed to be an operator.
I love how you're able to piece apart like what you love, what you're good at, and kind of marrying the two. And it must have been a lot of fun to also just get that experience, because not only through investing are you able to see a lot of different ideas and deals, but you're also able to pattern match, you know, mm-hmm. what makes really great founders, what makes really great businesses, you know, how does the go-to-market play into that? So you obviously had a lot to take away from your MBA. And then tell me a little bit about what afterwards looked like for you.
Yeah.
Because I'd been involved with Walker Brothers before. And then how did that kind of transpire after?
Yeah. So that's a very good question. So I was really fortunate to get an internship at Facebook and really did love my time there. Like a whole confluence of things happened kind of after the internship ended and after my time at Oxford ended. The biggest one being my husband was called back to the United States for work. And, you know, Facebook recruits on the summer cycle. So it was going to be a while before I would even like kind of start at Facebook if I was going to join them full time. So I had time, you know, when we moved back to the US. And so I was like, I've got this free time and, you know, I don't like to be idle. So we're like, we'll go to Nashville, we'll spend some time with family. And I was like, and I can embed with Walker Brothers again and like, you know, just kind of spend my time that way. And so by January, I was like, I can't leave. I was like, this is what I'm doing. We raised our first like friends and family round during that time. I led that all of that up. And I was like, I can't leave now, you know? So yeah, I remember I had this conversation with Sam and Luke standing outside of our old brewery where I was like, hey, like I've really enjoyed these past few months working alongside you guys to build this business. Like, what would you think of me joining full time? And they were like, we were hoping you would say this. You know, it was a really sweet moment where I was like, hey, can I come do this with you? You know, for realsies. And they're like, yeah. So that's how it happened.
That's awesome. And yeah, very, very meant to be. Now, you alluded a little bit to this, but especially in CPG and beverage, one of the big hurdles for really any founding team is the financing element. And so building a beverage business obviously requires quite a bit of capital for manufacturing and inventory and distribution. So in the early days, you know, how did you think about capital?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would say for us, we always knew that we would need to be self-manufactured for a couple of reasons. Our reason for being as a company is kind of like inherent in the way that we brew our kombucha. And if we were, you know, kind of as a small business, we wouldn't be able to dictate that brew process to a co-packer. And that's if we could even find a co-packer, because co-packers are really reluctant to touch kombucha because it is a live product. So two things immediately ruled out working with a co-packer, which that does eliminate a lot of upfront capital need if you are able to co-pack, because you're able to just produce kind of, you don't have all those like initial CapEx costs, you know, to like just get up and running, right? And you know, you're not running a facility, like you can just pay the co-man to make your product and then, you know, you got to sell it. So that wasn't really an option for us. So we knew that we would have a lot of CapEx need upfront. So initially that was financed by, you know, my husband's seed investment and then Sam and Luke's investment into the business. And then we did small friends and family fundraise and used that to expand our production capacity. And all the while too, we were like blending that equity capital with debt. Our like we used a lot of equipment finance agreements. We still use that. So these are underwritten to the piece of equipment itself rather than to the business. So what's nice about that is even though you're having to personally guarantee it because we're a brand new business, you're like, well, at least if things go wrong, there's a piece of equipment to sell. So that's initially what we did. And then we just kept growing, right? So like, you know, you get the capital you need, you grow, you hit some more milestones, and then you raise some more money. So the biggest kind of fundraise that we did was at the end of 2022, we raised just over $3 million to build out a new facility. So we had found with a brand new build warehouse in Nashville that was for lease. And so we raised specifically to build out this facility. And so we used most of the proceeds from that fundraise to build out the production facility, which is where we currently produce out of. Now we do a lot more on the debt side of things. Like we're pretty consistently like cash flowing these days. So that's good. One of the biggest lessons from those early days is figuring out who the right investor is for your, you know, for your business. We had much more of a kind of like controlled J curve, I would say. Like we always wanted profitability was always kind of our main goal, which now is very fashionable. But if you know, go back to 2019, 2020, 2021, it was not. And so we were kind of always moving toward that direction. So needed to find the right investors that were interested in that type of profile and were a bit more patient. And, you know, so that led us to family offices and then high net worths.
That's really helpful for a lot of founders to hear that perspective, because I think a lot of people, especially in the early days, immediately think about venture capital as a source of fundraising. And with that typically comes different types of expectations, both in terms of exit and timeline and acceleration. So I really appreciate you sharing a little bit about both the mix of friends and family, how you raise equity financing, but also the importance of debt, especially as it relates to your specific business, given the manufacturing and equipment. So that's really interesting and helpful. As you shared, when you were thinking about your distribution strategy, it wasn't, you know, get in every store immediately. Getting on shelves is generally really hard. And then certainly getting into multiple markets is often harder. How have you thought about your distribution strategy and how has that evolved over time?
Yeah, so this is really all down to Sam, one of my co-founders. His career was built in craft beer. So he had worked at a craft brewery. Then he went to go manage a big distributor's craft beer portfolio. And so he really knew that craft beer sales playbook in and out. And our thesis was that kombucha could be kind of like craft beer. And we could basically take a page out of that book, especially as beer consumption was going down and these distributors were looking for alternatives to beer to have in their portfolio. So we were able to get a great distributor in Nashville and kind of follow that playbook. So we wanted to sell our product into lots of local stores and places where we could really borrow brand equity from the establishment itself. So people were like, oh, if this is in, you know, Greenery, which is a really nice salad shop, or if this is in Barista Parlor, then it must be cool. It must be good quality. So we're going to buy it. And so that's how we were able to, I think, get off the ground without investing a lot in marketing advertising, anything like that, was really staying local and focusing on the own your backyard strategy. And then grew out of that, started out in Nashville, then got a, you know, like an East Tennessee distributor, then moved a little bit further east into North Carolina. And then in each new market, replicating that, where it's selling into these like small independent stores and really building up the brand at the community level. And that's still what we do, right? Anywhere we launch, especially if we're launching with one of those like kind of craft beer style distributors, that's our playbook for when we go into a new market. And then two, one of the other things that Sam is really talented at is, you know, he's been the sales rep before at these distributors. So he knows like what motivates them. He knows like kind of how to get them on side. So like, you know, even though, you know, we're 6 years in and like, he's, you know, he's a busy guy. Like he's still going to new markets and doing ride with the teams because getting founder attention is important. If you can get your distributor sales reps to love your brand and mention your brand first, then it means you don't have to have as many people in market, which is great from a financial perspective. So that was really our playbook from the beginning. And it's one that we still run, though we've layered kind of grocery on top of that. So if you think of that as kind of like one part of the business, which we run like our non-alc and our hard kombucha through, then there's grocery, which is kind of more traditional CPG. And so we waited a while before we entered grocery. That was intentional because we didn't have a lot of money to be spending on promotions and things. So we needed to have a certain level of awareness before we could go into grocery and even expect to be successful. And so our first real break in grocery came from Whole Foods. Our local forager brought our brand in to an 18-store test set and in Tennessee and Georgia, and our velocities were really strong. And so we took that as kind of like proof of concept to build our new facility and then go pitch into other grocery stores. And so the first like national account that we got was with the Fresh Market. And that's when we got our first like kind of national grocery activation. And we've really just grown from there. So we have one advisor who's been just really crucial in our ability to navigate the world of grocery and of grocery distribution. Really successful, scaled business. His name is Jason Burke from New Primal. And then to Startup CPG has also been so helpful for us learning that side of things. Because while Sam and then his brother Luke had a good understanding of craft beer dynamic, this was a totally new ball game for really anybody on our team. And so I kind of took that upon myself to be like, okay, I'm going to like learn everything there is about this. And so, yeah, really credit Startup CPG and all their resources. And then also Jason with helping me do that, helping the team do that.
I love how you have scaled sustainably, but developed that really strong cult following at the beginning in those individual markets and then now have much broader distribution. It's a really great lesson on making sure that you get it right in the early days and finding those screaming fans across the different networks and then being able to do it on a larger distribution and scale.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways to build a business. Like this isn't the only one, but it's working out, which is good.
I'm sure it will pay dividends. And clearly, you know, you're focused on expanding, you're focused on profitability. But when you think about Walker Brothers in 5 years, you know, what are you envisioning? What are you excited about?
Yeah, so I would love to be even more national than we are now. So we'd love to be national in Whole Foods. That's probably one of our biggest goals. So that's in 5 years time, hopefully that will be the case. But I think more than that, like, I think what's been really cool is to see how our team has evolved and grown over the past, you know, several years. And if our people are happy and are feeling fulfilled in their careers and, you know, we're all driving toward the same, you know, same goals, then the business is going to be successful. So I think for me, I'm going to have, you know, our same like kind of core employee group. I would love it if they're still all here in 5 years because they've been amazing and are, you know, the people that we need to keep the business going for the next five.
That's wonderful. Look, I imagine that there's some listeners that have dreams of, you know, becoming a founder or starting their own thing, but maybe hesitant to really take that jump. What would be your advice for them?
Well, I think if consumer goods founders are really honest with themselves, a lot of us, if we know what we knew now, we wouldn't have done it. And I think that's probably true of myself, Sam, and Luke. But, you know, we did it and here we are. And it, It's great. But I guess just like building a business is really tough. There's that funny quote. I think it's attributed to Elon Musk, but I'm not sure if he was the first person that said it. But it's like, we don't do these things because they're easy. We do them because we thought they were going to be easy. And so like, it's not easy. So just be prepared and go in like eyes wide open.
That's really good advice. So I want to end with some rapid fire questions, quick instinctive answers to the following questions. For you, what has been the best advice you've ever received?
Probably that your career is, it's not a career ladder, it's a career jungle gym.
What for you has been the worst advice you've received?
I can't really think of anything. If it was that bad, I probably just filtered it out and didn't commit it to memory.
That's really good. That's a good answer. What is the first thing you do every morning?
Check my phone, if I'm being really honest. I wish it weren't, but it usually is.
It's honest. Especially as a founder, you have a lot of things to keep up with. For you, you know, what does living a rich life mean?
Flexibility is huge, and intellectual stimulation and rewarding work, I think.
That's so great. And then the last thing is, what are you dreaming about next?
Oh, well, we have a fun new product we're debuting at Walker Brothers called Forest Water. It is a non-alc botanical soda, kind of meant for that adult non-alc category. And it is available in North Carolina and Tennessee, as well as on our website. I'm so excited and so proud of this product. And the team that came up with it at Walker Brothers. And yeah, I'm really excited to see where it leads.
That's really exciting. Thank you so much for this conversation, Caroline. I know I could talk to you for hours about a number of different dimensions of your career and your business and that you built. I really have loved our conversation and I appreciate your time.
That was Caroline Howard, co-founder of Walker Brothers. If you want to follow Caroline and Walker Brothers' journey, you can find them at drinkwalkerbrothers.com and drinkwalkerbrothers on Instagram. As always, if you love this episode, subscribe to Dreaming Big wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review. Remember, your credentials don't define your potential. Your work ethic, your character, and your commitment to growth do. So keep dreaming big. I'm Alexis, and I'll see you next time.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.